Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
Can I sleep with the class keys when I stay late at school?
Shortly after we left, my mother told me of another decision she had reached. I would no longer go to the private school.
Lo siento mucho.
No! 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 You can't do that to me! You can't do that to me! No, you can't do that to me!
Lucina,
you ruined everything! You ruined everything!
Agarra las cosas del suelo.
This ruins my life! You ruined everything! I will never forgive
you! Te prometo que todo estará bien. Vamos.
No!
Vamos,
no! It'll never be all right! You're wrong! This is exactly what I was worried about! I will never be able to forgive you! Nunca te perdonaré! Nunca! I have a scholarship! And nobody gives this up!
I had publicly scorned my mother. And yet she had not reacted. What did spark our climactic moment was my use of a common American phrase.
Not right now. I need some space.
Not a space between us.
Have you ever felt an emotional disconnect with your child? Find yourselves constantly fighting and feeling guilty that you've blown it again. If you answered yes to any of these questions, chances are you could use a little coaching to help your relationship. And that's just what we're going to talk about today with attachment expert and clinical psychologist, Dr. Gary Sipsey. He's going to show us how to start building emotional closeness with our kids that will last a lifetime, even through those difficult teen years. Dr. Sipsey is a speaker, author, and director of Liberty University's PhD program in professional counseling. Today is a must-listen-to program if you want to learn some concrete tools to build emotional closeness with your kids. Dr. Sipsey, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you very much.
You've done extensive research on attachment theory. So can you start us out by giving us an overview of attachment and how parents can use this theory of relationships to build emotional closeness with their kids? Because that really lays the foundation for this emotional coaching piece, doesn't it?
Well, it really does. Attachment theory is, it's a pretty big theory, but what I try to do is just sort of reduce it down to some core concepts. And one of them that we use is what we call the secure base model. And the basic idea with that is, kids use parents as a secure base. A child's basic sense of security comes from knowing, that a parent is available and can help them if they get in trouble or, if they get tired or they get hungry or they get sick, their parent's going to
be attuned
to them.
to help them get calmed down.
Mm-hmm. Even earlier, even before they even have that kind of self-awareness, kids actually really rely on the parent to help them get regulated. So if they're tired or if they're hungry or if they're upset, the parents work sort of with the child to help them figure out how to get calmed down. And so you know, there's not this self-regulation that kids have. It's what we call dyadic regulation. They're looking to the parent to help them really get get calm. But now when kids feel secure, what they do is they start to explore the world around them. And if you can picture in your mind just sort of a circle, some people refer to this as the circle of security. And, you know, as you start on the one side of the circle and you start and you feel secure, then you start to explore away from the parent. And this sort of this exploration is sort of the beginning of when children feel, you know, a sense of self-confidence. The idea that I can do something is sort of based on the belief that my parent's there for me if I get in trouble or if I get, you know, I get to feeling badly. And then, you know, when children get upset, they perceive some kind of threat. You know, a stranger comes into a room for a young child, or, you know, at school, the threat may be that there's a bully or there's somebody in the classroom who's picking on them, or, you know, they're not getting along with the teacher, or they, you know, they're being kind of shy and don't feel like they can speak up. Whatever it is that upsets them, this activates the attachment system. The attachment system, when that comes on, it's usually signaled, if you will, by a child feeling negative emotions, anxiety, anger, sadness, or, you know, they may be tired, they may be hungry, they may be feeling badly. When the attachment system comes on, then, you know, the desire to sort of explore the world and kind of be curious about things, that turns off. And kids begin to signal to parents that they're a problem. Now, the way that kids signal to parents is important. We're going to talk about that later when we talk about coaching. But some kids are really good at signaling. They're very good at letting their parents know that they got a problem, and they use their emotions and their other forms of communication to say, hey, there's a problem. Can you help me with it? Other kids are not so good at it. Some kids really have a hard time. When they get upset, they become very angry. They can be defiant. They can be, you know, quite difficult. And other kids can kind of withdraw. They don't really let you know that there's a problem. But part of parents being secure-based is that they help, is that they're pretty good at reading their kids' signals, especially their emotional signals. And it's during this phase, if you will, when kids are emotionally upset, that they're actually seeking parents as a safe haven. And this is the other side of the cycle. This is where kids are sort of circling back, completing the circle where they come back to the parents as a secure base, a safe haven. This is where they get calm, they get regulated, they figure out how to deal with the problem, and then they reestablish this sense of felt security, and then boom, they're back out to exploring the world. So if you will, you know, you imagine this circle, and, you know, I kind of picture it where it's, you know, in front of me, and on the left side of the circle is where, you know, the parent is sort of the stable point, the secure base. The child sort of moves away from that to the top of the circle, and if they get stressed, then they come back to the parents at the bottom of the circle to get re-energized. And once they do, then they're kind of back out to taking on the world. The importance of all this is that the ways that parents help kids deal with their emotions, that they attend to them, that they notice that it's there, that they engage them in problem solving and help them get calmed down, will eventually become internalized by the child as their own mechanism of coping. In other words, this will be their own way of dealing with stress as they grow older and they run into problems. The same kind of skills they learned in the parent-child relationship have become a part of their brain's neurocircuitry, and they'll use that themselves as they deal with stress, and then they'll pass that on to the next generation.
Yeah.
So that's the basic idea of how attachment sort of lays the groundwork to what we're talking about when we go into emotion coaching.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the attachment is that, you know, it sort of lays down this this model of relationships that kids have and they carry forward about what to expect from others, how to express their emotions to others when they're in trouble, their belief about whether or not people will help them, whether they can count on people, whether they can trust people, whether they have a sense of, you know, self-efficacy. Can I deal with things? Is the world manageable for me? And it translates into the way that they, you know, think about their relationship with God and in the future, and is he available and accessible? Those kind of things come to play. But the other piece is that these kind of relationship experiences go a long way in really influencing a child's brain development, their neurobiology.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to talk about. How does that affect the brain?
Right. So, you know, the brain, again, is recording all these things that occur in terms of it gets recorded into what we call implicit memory and procedural memory. These are parts of memory system that, you know, that sort of operate just below awareness, but they drive a lot of the things that we do. So, you know, for example, how you use language, how you understand syntax, how you read other people's nonverbal behaviors. You don't have to think about this. This just happens automatically because it's encoded into your brain's implicit memory system. It's kind of like on a computer, you have all this, you know, your operating system, and it's operating in the background behind all your programs. You don't really, you don't even come in contact with it. You're just dealing with programs like Microsoft Word or, you know, PowerPoint or whatever programs you like to play around with. They all work in the milieu of this operating system. Well, this is the way that attachment experiences get encoded into the brain as sort of a background operating system that tells you what to do and how to do it. That's one part. But the other is that some of the neuro circuits in the brain that influence certain cognitive skills, things that we'll talk about in a few minutes, things like emotion regulation skills to your social skills, how well you can read other people's nonverbal cues and how well you understand the way that, you know, your own behavior affects other people and how they affect you and how flexible you can be. Can you deal with adversity? Can you shift gears and go from working on one thing to another thing without getting all sort of jammed up? All these, what we call executive skills, are very strongly tied to early attachment relationships. And now some kids come into the world though with different abilities in each of these brain areas. So it's not like attachment determines everything, but attachment influences how your brain, how well your brain develops these capacities. And for some kids who come into the world, they're not very good at doing this. They're not going to learn these skills as easily as other kids, just like some kids learn reading better than other kids and math better than others. So you can't use the same teaching methods for every kid. You got to kind of adapt it to what they bring to the table. But there's a big, you know, we could really spend a whole week on the neurobiology of attachment, but the bottom line is that these early attachment experiences go a long way in shaping your brain's neurocircuits that are involved with a lot of things like emotion regulation and flexibility and problem solving and other what we call executive function skills.
Okay, so if a parent has a strong relationship with a child, what is that promoting for the child?
Well, you know, and it's when we say a strong relationship with a child, you can feel really close to your children, and they can feel really, you know, sort of close to you. You can watch them, you know, kids and their parents be very sort of warm and loving toward each other, and that's important. But attachment really is coming down to is how does the parent help the child deal with negative emotions? What happens when they get stressed? Even though these things may be related to each other, it's more technical. It's more about how do you respond to your kids when they get upset?
Mm-hmm. So the difficult child. What about the difficult child?
Well, right. Well, even, you know, you know, some kids are more difficult, some aren't. So you can use emotion coaching strategies for easy kids and more difficult kids. Obviously, it's easier to use with easy kids because they don't, you know, these skills come along more easily for them. You don't have to work so hard at it. And they won't necessarily overwhelm you. More difficult kids, you know, they sort of come into the world with some challenges that make it.
And that makes it hard for the parents because, you know, they're always arguing and knocking heads with these kids. And then kids are going to know whether you like them or not.
Exactly.
Or whether you accept them unconditionally or apart from their performance. And so if you're missing that piece, then they kind of get that, don't they?
Right.
And what does that do to them emotionally?
Well, you know, so again, it can translate into more insecure styles of attachment. And that's where, you know, one insecure style is where kids decide, you know what, I don't need you. I'll just rely on myself. And we call this avoidant or dismissing attachment, where, you know, people tend to keep their emotions, you know, close. They play their cards pretty close to them, and they don't like to show other people their negative feelings. They have a hard time opening up, and they, you know, become more performance-oriented, you know, perfectionist. And they're more concerned about, you know, sort of how many toys they have as opposed to how close they are to other people. Whereas another style of attachment would be, you know, where kids are very dependent and they don't feel like they can cope by themselves at all. And they are excessively dependent on the parent and they're, you know, and if the parent or if others aren't as available to them as they want them to be, they can be quite angry and grumpy and irritable and emotional. So both of them can kind of create some problems.
So what about the parent that feels like they haven't bonded with this more difficult child? How does that parent get the ball rolling with their kid to develop this emotional closeness?
Well, and that's where we bring in this whole concept of emotion coaching. Okay, so emotion coaching is a strategy to parenting. That now, by the way, you can use this with kids who aren't difficult, and we encourage you to think about some of these things. But you can, it also works fairly well, right, with kids who are struggling and who are challenging and who don't respond to the normal parenting practices that you may be used to. So the more easy a child is, in other words, the more they come into the world with certain certain cognitive skill, you know, executive skill abilities, you know, those things that we talked about, emotion regulation, social skills, there's sort of what we call language development, cognitive flexibility, problem-solving abilities. See, the more kids come into the world with some of these capacities and they develop sort of naturally and easily, then the more easy it is to use more traditional types of parenting where, you know, you pretty much tell kids the way it is and that's the way, go do this, go do that. I said do this, I said do that. If you don't do it, then this is going to happen or that's going to happen. You can use a lot of privilege, I mean, use a lot of rewards and consequences and kids respond just fine to that.
So some of this is intrinsic then. Some kids just come out of the chute and they're more
easy to manage,
yeah.
And they're more likely to respond to more traditional parenting practices. That doesn't mean that parents still shouldn't do emotion coaching. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's just that if you don't do it, it doesn't mean that it necessarily will have a real harmful effect on your kids. But emotion coaching strategies are especially useful for kids who have difficulties in each of these areas. So if your kid, you know, has always had a difficult time with regulation, you know, they were hard to get to sleep, they were hard to calm down when they got upset, they were, you know, they don't really get the social relationships that well, they don't understand how they affect other people's behavior, they kind of feel like a victim to the universe. They're always fighting with you. They can have emotional meltdowns. Now, this is especially useful for kids who are meltdowners. And again, a lot of times parents are going to look at these behaviors as forms of manipulation or as motivational problems, motivation deficits. And if you frame them that way, see, then you're going to even want to, you want to probably hammer them more with these consequence-based parenting, which tends to just backfire. You get even more and more of these meltdowns. But if you are able to reframe this and see it as, in part, underlying skill deficits, right, in these areas that we've talked about, I'll be happy to send you this chart that I use, this pyramid of self-control we talk about.
Oh, that's great.
You know, this capacity to control your behavior and to sort of live within limits, which is such an important capacity, is, if you will, we think of it as a capstone on a pyramid, you know, that it rests on top of the ability to sort of master a lot of other important skills. So self-control is what is really better understood as a sort of a developmental outcome. It's something that emerges as kids develop these other abilities. And I always tell parents, you know, you think about it in your own job, your ability to maintain a job and sort of, you know, stay employed rests on your ability to tolerate frustration and to have some social skills. So, you know, if your boss tells you, hey, you know, you need to work on Project A. Project A is the most important project. I mean, I need you to put all your effort and energy into that. So, you know, you're working away on Project A, you know, you spend late nights burning the midnight oil trying to get a project done, and you bring it to him. He says, well, I really need you to switch to Project B now. B is the most important. A is not so important. I mean, for you to keep your job and not melt down,
yeah,
requires that you have some
flexibility
of these
and skill. Yeah,
you got to have some frustration tolerance. You got to have some flexibility. You got to have some social skills here and problem solving ability, or you're not going to make it. We just tend to think that people develop these skills, you know, without any effort. And some people can, just like some people can learn how to read really easily, and parents don't have to do much at all, and their kids develop this capacity. But some kids just don't get it. And it's not an intelligence issue. It's just that, you know, there's certain brain mechanisms that interfere with their ability to learn how to read, how to decode, and how to understand different phonemes, and how to comprehend language. And those things just don't click so easily. So they need help at getting these underlying skills. That's where emotion coaching comes in. So that's where we talk to parents about the fact that being a good parent is a lot like being a good coach, you know, and good coaches have some, you know, some important qualities. If you watch good coaches, we're not talking about like pro coaches. See, the difference between a professional coach and, like, you know, the kind of coaches that you see in rec sports is that, you know, professional coaches get to pick their players very, you know, in a very systematic way. But rec coaches, you know, for rec sports, baseball, softball, these things, you don't know what you're getting. And that's a lot like parenting. You know, it's not like you get to pick the child that you want. You get the child that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, that's what you have to deal with. So good coaches, you know, they know each of the kids on their team. They know who's got skill, who doesn't have skill. And they don't assume that the different skills levels that these kids bring to the table are all because of motivational differences. It's not that, you know, you get this kid who can catch anything you hit to him, he can hit any ball you throw at him, he's fast and he's strong and he can do everything. You don't assume that's just because he's a motivated kid. He's got some underlying skill capacities that other kids don't have. Good coaches recognize that. So they know what some kids need to learn. They pay attention to how each kid learns it. They know what each kid's strengths and weaknesses are. And as a good coach, you know what your own hot spots are. In other words, you know the kind of kids that can get under your skin.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, as a parent, we all have hot spots. We all have blind spots. And believe me, your kids know them at least as well as you do.
Absolutely.
I'll almost always ask kids when I'm seeing them in therapy. And their parents are always surprised, you know, their kids really know them this well. But I'll say, do you know how to push mom and daddy's buttons? You know, they usually try to play it off like, well, no, what do you mean? Well, if you were going to make mommy mad, how would you do it?
Right.
But anyway.
So what are some practical ways that parents can engage their kids in some of these skills?
And what is emotion coaching? All right. So to do emotion coaching is one is that you have to, a good coach is not always outcome oriented. Right. So if you're always focused on if you're looking for an approach to get your kid to do what you want them to do when you want to do them, this isn't the approach for you, because this is more of a process oriented thing, not immediate outcome. Right. In the same way that if you wanted to get in shape and start building muscle and losing fat, somebody can give you a method, you know, go down to the gym and do workout X, you know. And after, you know, you're going to do the P90X workout. And after your first P90X workout, you look in the mirror and go, hey, you know what? This isn't working. Forget this crud. Mm-hmm. This is too painful.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. If you're going to build muscle and lose fat and get better condition, you're going to have a lot of...
takes 90 days.
It's going to take at least 90 days. In this case, I tell parents, you're going to probably need to have... Yeah, depending on what problem that we're working on, we usually try to narrow it down to one area or one problem situation that we begin to work on. But in a more general sense, though, I mean, what we try to do is help a parent first figure out, look, understand your child a little bit, right? Ask yourself, how well does your child handle? You got to sort of get a profile of your child on these skills. So. How much frustration tolerance does your child have? And frustration tolerance means if things don't go the way that they expect them to, how well do they handle that? Now, some kids can handle that pretty well. And other kids, they just don't handle frustration and they start to melt down.
Gary, we're out of time for today. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with our audience.
I appreciate it. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Join us next time as we continue our discussion with Dr. Gary Sipsey on attachment-based parenting and emotionally coaching your kids. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.